Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. We are continuing with the 50th episode of the podcast by discussing the individual segments that make up 1982's Creepshow. We've already discussed Father's Day, the lonesome death of Geordie Verrill, and the quite frightening story Something to Tide You Over. For the fourth segment, we have the tale that I would guess that most fans of the movie remember very fondly, The Crate.
This was a strong contender for my favorite story for the anthology, Sage.
For good reasons, Projectionist. Everything mixes together perfectly in this segment. The cast, the music, and the special effects. I've always felt it has a little touch of Lovecraft to the story as well. The Crate, like The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, is an adaptation of King's short story of the same name that was originally published in July of 1979. As the segment begins, after the comic book illustration transitioned to live action, as all of the segments have, we are introduced to Mike the Janitor, played by Don Kiefer.
This is the same Don Kiefer, dear listeners, from the 1961 Twilight Zone episode, It's a Good Life. He's the unfortunate man who dares to resist the all-powerful Anthony Fremont.
Indeed. Friends, you might remember Christopher Tupa talking about that episode on our second Halloween special.
How many times must I remind you, Victor? That special was cancelled when that heavy door swung closed on your head and knocked you out.
Oh, right. Sorry, I keep forgetting. I just remember it so vividly.
Head trauma can play all manner of tricks on a person, Sage.
And I suppose so. Mike, as we soon learn, is the custodian for Horlicks University. Mike drops a quarter and it hits the floor, enrolling underneath a nearby set of basement stairs. As there's a type of metal latticework blocking entry, the elderly man can't reach his coin. He quickly forgets about that when he spies a dusty and cobweb-strewn wooden crate pushed far in the back under the stairs. Especially when he makes out what is stamped upon the front of the crate.
Ship to Horlicks University via Julia Carpenter. Arctic Expedition, June 19th. 1834.
Many fans of Creepshow feel this was a nod to John Carpenter's The Thing, as his wife at the time, Adrienne Barbeau, is featured in this segment. Romero would have known that Carpenter was working on his film. But remember that this short story was published in 1979, and in the original story, it does mention Julia Carpenter and the Arctic Expedition. This just happens to be a nice bit of happenstance. We switch from the university to a garden party for the residing Horlicks faculty, where we meet our three main protagonists, English professor Henry Northrup, played by Hal Holbrook, his gregarious wife Wilma, masterfully portrayed by Barbeau, and Henry's best friend and head of the zoology department, Professor Dexter Stanley, who is played by Fritz Weaver. It's evident right off the bat that Wilma isn't just drunk and loud, but brutally mean as we watch her verbally assault both Dexter and Henry.
Wilma Northrup is the epitome of uncouth, and it is obvious that everyone at the gathering is embarrassed by her presence.
We the viewers can tell as Henry behaves, it's like he's been beaten down by his wife's aggressive and condemning personality. She never misses a chance to quite loudly criticize him to anyone nearby. When the dean of Horlicks University introduces two new professors, a husband and wife named Tabitha and Richard, Wilma, or as she continuously tells people, to call her Billy, is quick to take over the conversation. Not only slighting Tabitha on her clothing, but making a point to put Henry down to boot.
When Wilma Northrup takes Tabitha Raymond's husband by the arm to get him a drink, we see the dean shoot both Henry Northrup and Dexter Stanley a stern look.
Yeah, I think that Wilma's behavior has possibly put Henry's job in jeopardy, and Dexter by association. His friend even gives Henry a kind of apologetic glance before removing himself far away from Wilma as he can. A few moments later, Wilma drunkenly offends even more partygoers, and she happens to spy Dexter chatting with a young college co-ed, the older man asking the young woman if they might not meet up later that evening. Wilma smirks wickedly at having seen this, and this will become important later, but Dexter is interrupted by his friend's arrival. Henry and Dexter have a weekly scheduled chess game, and Northrop smiles knowingly when he tells his friend that he assumes that he won't show up that evening. This seems to be the only bit of happiness that Henry gets out of life of late, so Dexter rather sheepishly agrees to show up. The two professors are interrupted when a hostess informs Dexter that he has a phone call. Stanley assumes it's a young student of his, Charlie Garrison, who, we are told, is a very bright and dedicated pupil. So much so that he's consumed with doing research at the university's Amberson Hall during summer break. Of course, it's Mike on the phone who is eager to tell Dexter what he has discovered. To be honest, Stanley is a little dismissive at first, but then good-naturedly offers his guess that the crate is just filled with old National Geographic and Reader's Digest magazines.
The custodian informs Dexter Stanley of the date and point of origin upon the wooden box. A little before the time of Reader's Digest, eh?
This certainly changes Dexter's tune. And really, who wouldn't be interested in opening up a 147-year-old box of mystery? As Dexter Stanley drives to Amberson Hall, Henry Northrop is left alone. Something passes behind his eyes, as if he's finally come to an important decision.
Indeed. We can hear his wife going off in front of Richard and Tabitha about the political backstabbing at the university. That is when Henry loudly calls for her attention as he opens up his jacket and pulls out a very large handgun and aims it at Wilma. When the woman turns to ask what he wants, she is shot in the head. As Wilma Northrop slumps down dead, the gathered partygoers begin to applaud. Richard and Tabitha even remark it was a good shot.
This is, of course, all just a dark daydream of Henry's. Wilma is just fine. I think this clues us in on just how bad things are for Holbrook's character. Meanwhile, Dexter has reached Amberson Hall, and with Mike's help, they are able to drag out the absolutely filthy crate, thanks to the chains wrapped around it. It seems to have a bit of heft, as both men carry the large wooden box to a nearby lab. As they are placing the crate up on one of the lab's tables, Mike presses his ear against the wood. Dexter asks what is wrong, and the elderly man replies that it sounded like something shifted within, on its own. The professor laughs and reminds Mike that if live specimens had been shipped, they probably wouldn't be too spry after 147 years.
Ever the man of science is Dexter Stanley. He will regret that thinking soon enough.
Mike goes to grab a hammer and chisel so they can open the crate, which is when we are treated to another murder fantasy of Henry's as his wife is leaving for her classes. The entire time just berating him. This must be a 24/7 occurrence, and I truly have no idea why the poor man wouldn't have already gotten a divorce. Back at Amberson Hall, Dexter and Mike are getting to work on the crate, prying up the ancient nails that have kept the lid secured for over 14 decades. Mike gets the lid up just a little, and a great blast of dust is released from within the crate, both men momentarily gagging as they are hit in the face with it.
I took it that there was a horrible smell emanating from within the crate as well, Victor.
Yeah, that makes sense, considering what is within hasn't had a bath in a long time. As they regain themselves, the two men can hear something. A chattering that is coming from within the crate. Honestly, it sounds very much like a capuchin monkey. Mike has left his flashlight underneath the basement stairs, so the two men are forced to peer into the darkness of the wooden box. From within, we can see two golden eyes gazing up, full of malicious intent. Mike, foolishly, reaches his hand in and begins to scream as we hear something ripping into his arm.
Sage has mentioned that much of Creepshow is designed to make a viewer feel like they are watching a living funny book. The scene is bathed in red to indicate the horror and pain Mike, the janitor, is in as Dexter Stanley tries to pull the older man back.
Although we don't get a good look at it, something reaches out of the crate and knocks Dexter back. The crate is turned over on the table as Mike slumps to the floor, his arm still being held and feasted upon greedily by whatever is within the wooden box. Dexter tries to inch closer to reach Mike, who is blessedly going into shock, judging from the amount of blood pouring down his arm.
As the professor of zoology is almost able to reach Mike, that is when the lid of the crate pops out and upwards momentarily to reveal the nightmarish beast lurking within. It is a yeti-like creature with an enormous maw of razor-sharp teeth, drool dripping from its chin as it roars a challenge at Dexter Stanley.
As Dexter leaps back in fright, the creature leans a furry arm out of the crate, its long fingers topped with black, sharp nails, and pulls poor Mike's head up into the crate, where the man screams in fear and pain as a torrent of blood begins to pour down his chest and across the floor. Dexter screams in horror and flees the lab, just in time to literally run into Charlie Garrison. The professor is understandably panicking over what just happened, making no sense as he babbles about what killed Mike. Stanley's behavior is sending up all manner of warning flags to Charlie, who tries to remain calm, but it's pretty obvious he is suspecting that Dexter has lost it and possibly murdered Mike.
Especially when the young man, against his professor's wishes, gets a glimpse of the lab. Oh, dear listeners, there is so much blood, yet there is no crate.
True. While Dexter was doing his best to get Charlie to believe him, we the viewer see the monster moving its crate back under the basement stairwell, leaving a bloody trail behind it though as it does so, which is what ultimately convinces Charlie that Dexter isn't insane. Against his professor's pleas, the young man has to investigate under the stairwell. Dexter is continuously begging that they both just leave and go get help. He's probably thinking something like a SWAT team. The young man has found the remains of one of the custodian's shoes. It looks like it's been through a farm thresher, and Charlie mentions he wants to measure the bite marks on it. Taking the precaution of picking up a very heavy wrench, he uses Mike's flashlight to roll the shredded footwear to his professor. We the viewers, of course, can't help but be on pins and needles, because while he isn't fully under the stairs, we've seen just how fast that creature can pop out of the crate.
Which is exactly why it comes as a surprise to Charlie Garrison when death comes not from within the crate, but beside him.
Exactly. The creature wasn't in the crate at all, but hiding under the stairwell. The young man turns just in time to see it open its bloody maw of a mouth. Dodging out of the way as it leaps forward, the monster lashes out and leaves a bloody gash on Charlie's shoulder. Dexter also cries out in alarm, which causes the beast to turn and growl at him. Charlie takes this moment to pick up the wrench and crack the monster in the back of the head with all of his strength,
which results in nothing. The creature leaps back upon Charlie Garrison and the two struggle. For a moment, the young man almost gets away. Long enough, at least, to reach an arm out toward Dexter Stanley. That is when the beast leans in and bites a large chunk out of the shrieking student's neck. And, as a final insult, it shreds the young man's face with the swipe of a claw.
It's a horrible and bloody scene, to say the least. This is a good point to shine a spotlight on King's great job on the screenplay. By adding that bit of dialogue between Dexter and Henry at the party, at what a bright future Charlie had, it's all the more painful when we see him slain. Dexter can bear no more, and with Mike's bloody shoe in hand, flees for his life up the stairs, as we the viewers see the creature dragging the remains of poor Charlie under them. Stanley, it turns out, heads straight to Henry's house, and when the door is open, Dexter rushes in, and if you thought he was not making any sense before when talking to Charlie, you should hear him now. He's been reduced to a gibbering madman.
The scene has a delicious bit of dark humor, as the only thing that momentarily snaps Dexter Stanley out of his fear is the thought that Wilma Northrup might be at home.
Absolutely. Fritz Weaver is phenomenal in this scene, as Henry gets him to calm down enough to throw back a stout drink. After Dexter is able to calm down slightly and tell the horrid tale of what he experienced earlier, he is relieved to find that Henry believes him. For one thing, the professor did bring Mike's shoe with him, so Henry is able to see for himself the large bite marks of the beast. Henry, though, while quite eager to help his friend out, is hatching a dark plan to rid himself of Wilma's abuse once and for all. Excusing himself to retrieve a sleeping pill from the medicine cabinet, he talks Dexter into having one more drink before they head to the university to deal with the beast. Once Dexter succumbs to the drug, Henry sets to work, crafting a note for Wilma, one that he's positive will make her come to Amberson Hall. By the way, friends, that marble ashtray from Father's Day that is in all segments of Creepshow makes its appearance on the desk while he's writing the note. Remember earlier when I mentioned Wilma spying Dexter talking to the young co-ed would be important? This is the moment why. Henry rushes to Amberson Hall, cleaning up all of the blood and gore in the lab and under the stairs. While he is hurriedly doing this, Wilma returns home, amused when she finds and begins to read the note her husband left for her. This clip is just a little bit longer than we normally share. There are three reasons I'm including this. One, it's a good showing of Hal Holbrook's excellent acting ability. Two, it really drives home just how horrible a person Wilma is. Three, it includes my second favorite theme from the movie by composer John Harrison. Take in how the music marries perfectly with the dialogue.
Wilma, I've had to leave in a hurry because of a call from Dexter Stanley. He seems to have gotten himself in a great deal of trouble. I'm ashamed to tell you of this, but ever since Dexter's wife died, he's had problems coping with certain young female grad students. He's been able to cover up several incidents, but this one looks very serious. It seems he got a young woman to accompany him to Amberson Hall under false pretenses and then attacked her. When Dex called me, he was barely coherent. He was gibbering with fear and crying, I think.
Oh, poor Dex.
I tried to get him to tell me what had happened to the girl, but for the most part, he only kept repeating, "It's awful, Henry. It's awful." Wilma, could you come out here? I know it's asking a lot, but you're always so clear-headed about these things. And you know how to be firm. I think Dex could use a firmer hand than mine right now. Not to mention the girl herself. He said that she had curled up in a dark place and won't come out. I'm sorry to have to ask you to come over to Amberson Hall and help me out. But as you so often say, what would I do without you?
What indeed, Henry? What indeed?
Wilma Northrup arrives at the university. She's called down to the basement by her husband. The shrew is quite excited to see the supposed girl curled up under the basement stairs.
Henry, after trying to get Wilma to go underneath the stairs, forcibly grabs her and pushes her next to the crate. But the creature doesn't make an appearance. Wilma is beginning to think this is all some kind of sick joke, and is getting angry, especially when Henry grabs her and begins to cry out for the monster to make an appearance, and literally starts slamming her back against the crate. His wife seems more than able to handle her own, however, as she begins to wail on him with her purse until he retreats back to the opening under the stairs. Then, the Wilma we've come to know begins to emerge, as she just tears into Henry, not just because of his recent behavior, but his failures as a provider. As a husband, even as a man.
That is why it is a shock to them both when the creature pops up from the crate. Perhaps it's already heard enough from the woman.
Wilma has only a brief moment to scream in terror before the creature latches its large jaws around her face. Henry struggles not to vomit at what must be the feeding carnage before him. But he manages to stick around long enough to mouth off to her, "Just tell it to call you Billy." Later in the evening, Henry is forced to clean up after the monster, and once everything is back in place, as if no one had been at the university that day, Henry very carefully approaches the crate and is able to padlock the chains, securing the monster within, and whatever might remain of Mike, Charlie, and Wilma. Using a dolly to transport the crate to his car, the English professor drives out to a place called Ryder's Quarry, where the water, we are told, is at least 70 feet deep. At this point, friends, Henry is narrating to Dexter the next morning, very matter-of-factly explaining what he did. Henry makes note that it seemed the creature at the end sensed what was to come, and we the viewers, thanks to the flashback, hear it whimper almost sadly as the man tips the crate over the quarry and it disappears beneath the water.
The elephant in the room is if Dexter Stanley plans on approaching the constables with the matter.
Yeah, but as Henry points out, there is literally no evidence to link Dexter to the events at the university, nor himself. Stanley, relieved, if a little wary, sees no reason to involve the police. And Henry adds that he expects his friend to come by his home now, twice a week for the rest of their lives, so they can enjoy their chess matches. Dexter is still hesitant about the fate of the monster in the crate. But Henry, in a good mood for the first time in the segment, tells him to relax as he chained the crate up tightly, and the creature obviously drowned at the bottom of Ryder's quarry.
Except for as the segment comes to an end, we see deep under the water the clawed hands of the monster emerge from the crate to crack open its wooden prison. As the scene transforms to a funny book illustration, we are treated to the creature's golden eyes staring up from the depths.
That, friends, is the full synopsis for The Crate. Projectionist, before we jump into some of the fun facts about The Crate and the notable cast and crew, did you bring any drive-in goodies for the listeners?
Marry a one.
Oh. Well, the special effects for the creature in the crate that was nicknamed Fluffy by Romero on the set was handled by Tom Savini. It was basically a large puppet for the attack scene and a full-body costume for wide shots. Before the show, I found a site called Tom Spina Designs that mentioned they had worked on preserving the screen-used puppet and restoring the costume for a collector. I'll be sure to include a link in the podcast post on the Retroist. The crate itself is still around. Three prop crates were constructed for the segment of the film by the late production designer Cletus Anderson. One, that was originally owned by George A. Romero, belongs to David Burian, a prop collector and film archivist. The other two crates are in the collections of KMBFX co-owner Greg Nicotero, who purchased it from Tom Savini, and Creepshow soundtrack composer John Harrison. The crate just recently made an appearance in a rather popular TV series. In the season 5 premiere episode of The Walking Dead, which 17.9 million people tuned into, Nicotero, who is executive producer, a director, and head of the series' makeup department, managed to sneak the crate into a scene. You can clearly see the bloody claw marks on it with an open padlock, as well as the ship to Horlicks University via Julia Carpenter, etc. Horlicks University itself was seen again in Creepshow 2, at least in name, as the character of Laverne, played by Jeremy Green, is seen wearing a t-shirt with the school's name on it in the segment entitled The Raft. The other characters in the car talk about school, so I assume they too are Horlicks University alumni. Just one more thing. Adrian Barbeau, Hal Holbrook, and Tom Atkins from the Creepshow intro all appeared together in John Carpenter's 1980 classic The Fog.
We should also mention that Fritz Weaver is also an alumni of the Twilight Zone, appearing in The Obsolete Man, which we discussed on an earlier broadcast, and Third from the Sun.
I think that's a good spot to jump into the notable cast then, Projectionist. As my co-host already mentioned, we did discuss Fritz Weaver before on the show, so let's move on to Hal Holbrook. Holbrook has 129 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in 1976, All the President's Men, Midway, 1977's Capricorn 1, the TV miniseries The North and the South, Books 1 and 2, 1987's Wall Street, 2007's Into the Wild, and 2012's Lincoln. Adrian Barbeau has 126 acting credits, with notable roles in film and TV, such as 94 episodes of the 1972 hit series Maude, 1978's Someone Is Watching Me, which was directed by John Carpenter. They would team up again for 1981's Escape from New York. That year, Barbeau would appear in The Cannonball Run and Wes Craven's film adaptation of DC Comics' Swamp Thing. And she was also in John Carpenter's The Thing, an uncredited role as the voice of the chess computer that stymies Kurt Russell's character. Recently, she provided the voice of Pink Eye in the Mad Max video game. Don Kiefer passed away in 2014, with 174 roles to his name. Notable appearances in TV and film include two more roles in the original Twilight Zone series, with From Agnes with Love and Passage on the Lady Anne. He was also in 1969's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1973's Sleeper, and The Way We Were. His last role was in 1997's Liar Liar, as a beggar at the courthouse. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to the Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
I'm sometime on the Facebooks. Projectionist. Haunted Drive-In.
Saturday Frights has a Facebook page as well, and we'd greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. The podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and I can be found nearly every day on the Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to the Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in the Retroist vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
We gotta stop. The people are dead already. We gotta do.
Hey, Dex, hold it. What happened?
Two people are dead already. And
who's dead?
Where's Wilma?
She's gone. Dex, what the hell happened to you?
Two people are dead, and I could be blamed. I know that's a terrible consideration to have at a time like this, Bindi.
Good God. Last time I saw someone do that was in the movies.
Really, it wasn't me. It was that thing in the crate. I don't even know what it was.
What two people? Who is dead?
Mike, the janitor in Amberson Hall. Charlie Garris. He wanted to measure the bite marks, Henry. I guess he got his chance. I surely guess he did.
I can't do anything for you unless you tell me the whole story from the beginning. Can you do that?
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.